You are listening to the Cycling Podcast.
Hello and welcoming you on Tuesday, March 26th from Sóller in Mallorca, where I'm house-sitting for Eurosport commentator Rob Hatch. My name's Daniel Freema. I'm the host of this episode of the Cycling Podcast, which we'll begin by wishing 1997 world champion Laurent Brochard a happy birthday. Happy 56th birthday. Brochard was, of course, the first cyclist to pair a mullet hairstyle with a rainbow jersey, and Mathieu van der Poel was the most recent to do that, though the mullet did disappear last weekend. We'll, of course, be talking about E3 Harald Becker winner MVDP in this episode. And since we're already talking about Bundesliga haircuts, four Cohilas, as discussed last week, mullets, it's time to welcome our first guest to this week's pod. It's Mitch Docker. And Mitch, I do apologise for this because I feel as though I have gone in with the mullet before, and we shouldn't reduce you to just a hairstyle. Whether it's the mullet or the moustache, there's a lot more to Mitch Docker than just, you know, his Bundesliga haircut. But how are you?
I'm very well. It's good to be here. I'm excited. It's classic season, and hasn't it just delivered? The racing always gets good this time of year. The mullet is something, you know, I have got rid of it a couple of times, but I feel a bit naked without it. I feel like it's... Is it destined to be there for the rest of my life? That's what I'm wondering.
Did you see this Van der Poel mullet? Because I feel as though it was a bit of an error. But I mean, it was barely discernible under the helmet a couple of weeks ago, and then it has disappeared, which led me to question whether it was ever there in the first place.
That sounds like a Luke Rowe mullet to me. He used to claim he had a mullet. He had a little tiny bit of, you know, little couple strands of hair flopping out the back of his helmet. That's not a mullet. It's just like your hair's a little bit longer.
A bit of fluff. Mitch, I mentioned we talked last week about how they're known as Bundesliga haircuts in Denmark. Any good names for them in Australia? Because they're probably, well, Australia is the country where they are most common, I would suggest, in the wild.
Mullets, mullets, that's about it, really. You get a skullet every so often, skin on the top. It's like a balding guy who's got the mullet at the back. Business at the front, party at the back, you know.
Well, happy birthday indeed to Laurent Brochard, whose mullet was a magnificent one. And it was a very extravagant one, wasn't it? A very long one.
Oh, yeah. One of the best.
Continuing the lookalike theme, it's now time to welcome our second guest and indeed to congratulate him on winning the Settimana Coppa Bartali at the weekend. It is the Visma Lisa Bike rider who occasionally moonlights under the nom de guerre podcaster Young Richard Abraham. How are you, Kern or Richard?
Thanks, Daniel. Mitch? Yeah, I think you've condemned me now to whenever Kern pulls off a result, my phone sort of starts buzzing and messages of congratulations come in.
So it was very timely, wasn't it? It was very timely. We talked about that last week, didn't we?
But I think Kern, if it's possible, looks even younger than me. Quite a bit lighter, definitely more tanned, blonder. But yeah, I can see it. There's definitely certain angles where it... You know, you see the resemblance.
And to a certain extent, you saved Visma Lisa Bike's quite ragged or unlucky, ill-starred weekend. Maybe we'll talk about that later.
Don't put it all down to me, Daniel. I had very little part in this.
Later in the podcast, we'll maybe discuss this. That's a very, very unfamiliar on the podcast to be talking about Visma Lisa Bike struggling. And more commonly, over the last couple of years, we've been talking about them sweeping all before them, but that wasn't the case. This weekend, let's talk a little bit more about this weekend and indeed events of last week. Richard Kern, shall we? You're in charge of the news roundup again. And, tell us what's been going on.
Well, should we start with Kern? Well, sort of the best result for Visma Lisa Bike, wasn't it? It was a Settimana Internazionale Coppa e Bartali in Italy. Kern Baumann won it ahead of Archie Ryan of EF Education Easy Post, and Diego Ulisi of UAE Team Emirates was third. It was the third stage Baumann won, and that was where he took his GC lead and, well, never relinquished it, really. It's quite in looking down the results there, a race of youth, really. Ryan, who finished second, took a stage win. He's just 22. It's his Neo Pro year. Marco Brenner, a much talked about rider from Germany. I guess, Daniel, you've probably been aware of him for a while as well. And has he got a reputation in Germany? A future Tour de France winner or future star of the sport?
Yeah, he first came to, I think, wider attention at the Vuelta a couple of years ago with, I forget where we were. There was a stage when he was in a break where Richard Carapaz won, and he came pretty close and was indeed strong in that Vuelta. And last year, at the end of last year, there was a lot of speculation about where he would end up. He's ended up at Tudor.
Well, he's ended up at Tudor, yeah. And it was his first pro win. I mean, he turned pro at 18, so it's hardly like he's been hanging around, still only 21. And at the same time, amongst all this youth, Domenico Pozzovivo, 41, who's eighth overall in Coppi Bartali. He's building to his 18th Giro d'Italia, if I read the stats correctly. So not just a race of youth over there in Italy. But yeah, let's get on to, well, the big stage race really of the week was Volta a Catalunya. Daniel, your term, is it pogcineration?
Yes.
Okay, yes. Can I
you can
legitimately, yes, cite a pogcineration? Because that, I think, maybe sums up what we witnessed at Catalunya, which concluded on Sunday. 3:41 was the time gap by the end of the seventh and final stage between Pogacar and second overall, which was Mikel Landa, who now rides for Sudal Quickstep, of course. And Egan Bernal was a further minute and 20 seconds down on Landa. He came third. It was actually Bernal's first World Tour podium since 2021, which was worth noting, that being the Giro in 2021. But really, the story belonged to Pogacar. He won the mountains classification, the points classification, and four stages. He probably could have won more. I mean, we talked about last week the stage where he narrowly came second, the opening stage to Nick Schultz. I don't know if you saw Thomas de Gendt put on his Strava file for the final stage. It's Poggy's world. We just live in it. Kind of sums it up. The jersey he didn't win, he would have done had he been younger, but now he's too old, was the best young rider. That was Lenny Martinez of Groupama FDJ who won that. He came seventh overall.
I think I read somewhere that was the first stage race that Pogacar had taken part in which he'd not won the young rider's jersey for over 3 years, I think.
Well, there were stage wins when Pogacar sort of, well, he didn't let them have a go. There was one actually where he tried to sprint against well, the eventual winner, Axel Laurence, Alpecin de Koenig. He kind of got boxed in. He was having a go, I think. Laurence took one stage, and Marijn van den Berg of EF Education Easy Post took another, as well as Nick Schultz on the first stage. So, yeah, I mean, we'll come on to that, won't we? The pogcineration of the Volta a Catalunya, part of Pogacar's quest to be the best rider of all time. Well, let's head over to Belgium, and I'm not quite sure when the Belgian Holy Week starts, but it started possibly at the Classic Bruges de Panne, which was last Wednesday. Maybe a little precursor to the Holy Week. In any case, that was won by Jasper Philipsen of Alpecin de Koenig, who's still continuing his good form after San Remo. A little messy sprint, really, with Sudal Quickstep's Tim Melia. Melia not really happy with the argy-bargy there in that finale, but commissaires didn't see any reason to demote Philipsen. Danny van Poppel was third, and a chap called Jason Tesson of Total Energies. I've not seen the name before. He was fourth, and he actually got to the top step of the podium a few days later at the Rue Tourangel in Tours, another Coupe de France race. In the women's race on Thursday, that was won by Elisa Balsamo of Lidl Trek, ahead of Charlotte Kohl of DSM Firmenich Post NL, and Daria Pikulic from Human Powered Health was third. We'll fast forward another 24 hours and to the E3 Saxo Classic, as it's now known, formerly E3 Price, E3 Harelbeke, and what was the first meeting of Mathieu van der Poel and Wout van Aert on the road this season. A dress rehearsal, really, for this weekend's Tour of Flanders, in fact. It was on the Paterberg where things unfolded. Van der Poel had been sort of kneading the peloton out all day, and he finally made a permanent gap in it with, one of his sort of van der Poel classic attacks on the Paterberg. I'm not sure if he noticed that Wout van Aert had slipped and crashed at the bottom of the climb, but that was certainly the case. Van der Poel went off alone. Wout van Aert went off alone in chase on the next climb, the Alder Quaremont. He got the gap down to about 12 seconds. He could sort of tantalizingly see Van der Poel up the road, but that was pretty much as close as it got. And it was on the next climb, on the run into Harelbeke, the wonderfully named Karnemelkbeekstraat, which I had to Google translate while watching it. It means the Buttermilk Brook Street, which is, I'd love to have that on my address. he kind of cracked Van Aert without riding with him. He just did another sort of burst up that climb. And I think Van Aert, you know, the gap started to go out, and that was that, really. Van Aert did get caught by Jasper Stuyven on that final run into town, and Stuyven got second, so third for Van Aert. Again, we'll come on to that and discuss Van Aert, who just come back down from altitude camp. So that was his first race, and perhaps missing a bit of that sharpness there. Well, Sunday was Gent-Wevel game. The last rider to do the double E3 Gent-Wevel game, chaps. Little quiz corner.
Mitch Docker.
Sagan.
Not Sagan. Right, around the right sort of time, though. It was Greg Van Avermaet, 2017. And before that, Tom Bonin, 2012. So it doesn't happen very often, is my point. But it almost did this year. Van der Poel was up there. But I guess you could call it a victory of a strong team over a strong individual in the end. Mads Pedersen being the leader of that strong team, Lidl Trek. He outsprinted Van der Poel. It was a superb effort from Lidl Trek, I thought, actually. Van der Poel was very much the protagonist, but Lidl Trek just sort of surrounded him with these primary coloured jerseys. I mean, at one point they had three riders in the front move of seven, which was impressive to see, and they played it well. It left Pedersen and Van der Poel out front over the last climb of the Kemmelberg. They dropped the last remnant of that breakaway. Lawrence Pithy, 21, another impressive ride for him. I'm sure we'll be talking about him much more in the future.
Chute à l'arrière du peloton, cycling podcast team car at the back of the pack, please.
That's Seb Piquet, the voice of Radio Tour, to remind me to tell you that this episode is sponsored by Babbel. Now, one of the many things, the many, many things that I envy Daniel is his comfort, fluidity, fluency, ease with foreign languages. He's fluent in, as well as English, French, Italian, Spanish, German. He may even have added another one since I last spoke to him earlier this week. I don't know, but he really has a natural affinity with language learning, and that's not something that comes as easily to everyone. But Babbel can help change that one lesson at a time. And with just 10 or 15 minutes on the Babbel app, you can start to put into place the building blocks for learning a second language. There are 14 languages to choose from, and crucially, the thing about Babbel is you're not learning AI-generated or computer-generated phrases. You're learning the language in a way that a real language teacher has put together. So there's a kind of logic to the learning journey. You start right at the beginning with phrases that you might use in real-world situations. You're not just learning kind of meaningless, for want of a better word, babble. You're learning real language from the off. And as I say, with just the short lessons each day, little and often, you can make real progress in quite a short period of time. You can pick it up and put it down as and when you see fit, really, and the app will always remember where you got to. I've done that with Italian over the last couple of years, and each time I go back to it, I kind of review what I'd learned so far and just kind of reinforce that and add a little bit more at a time. Now, if you would like to learn another language or perhaps improve English if English isn't your first language, take advantage of Babbel's amazing offer today. Right now, Babbel is offering all of our listeners 6 months free when you purchase a 6 month subscription. You just need the promo code cycle24. Go to babbel.com/play and use the promo code cycle24 to get an extra 6 months for free when you buy a 6 month subscription. That's babbel.com/play and the promo code is cycle24. Babbel, your guaranteed path towards speaking a new language.
Talking of Brosha, talking about that era, one of our colleagues yesterday, Jan-Peter de Vlieger of Het Nieuwsblad, contacted me. He was doing a deep dive about the return of, and I haven't noticed this, to be honest, I hadn't even noticed the fact that they'd gone away, the Breathe Right nose strips. Apparently they're making a comeback. They're coming back with a vengeance. Ooh. And Jan-Peter asked me whether I had any good stories about or any recollections of these in connection with Jan Ulrich in the 1990s, and I said I don't think it was Ulrich that wore Cloden. Them that premiered them. Cloden, yeah, but I had a memory of the 1996 Tour de France and 1997 as well, of Bjarne Riis having a sponsored logo, a magenta T-Mobile logo on his Breathe Right strip. And so yesterday afternoon, I delved deep into the sort of Brochard era of professional cycling, the mid and late 90s, looking for evidence of this. And I did find it. And that was also what got me thinking about Brochard and his birthday.
I've completely lost track of where we were. I think we'd just gone over the Kemmelberg, I think, in Kemmelgem. It was Pedersen and Van der Poel. They stayed away on that long run down to Wevelgem, I think aided by a tailwind, as it turned out, on the day. Pedersen went long, which I think consensus is the way to beat Van der Poel in a sprint. Go early, go long, and Van der Poel just, he knew he didn't have it. Perhaps a little worn out from 50-something kilometres alone on the Friday. But that was a very impressive win from Pedersen, actually, and from Trek, so definitely in the picture for Flanders, as I'm sure we'll come on to. And they did it again in the women's race. Slightly different tactics. Lidl Trek did a lot of the work, working hard all day to keep the bunch together for a final sprint. And, well, it was only a photo finish, really, that stopped Elisa Balsamo making it two in a row. She lost out to Lorena Wiebers of ST Works Pro Time. That's the team's 12th win this season already. And Chiara Consoni of UAE Team ADQ was third there. So, as I mentioned at the start, Flemish Holy Week is definitely in full flow. This week we've got the Dwars del Vlaanderen on Wednesday, men's and women's races there. It's the Gran Premio Miguel Indurain, which is not in Flanders. It's in Navarre, isn't it, Daniel? I think. And then, of course, Tour of Flanders on Sunday. And Itzulia Basque Country, another week-long stage race. Podgy's not going to that one, but I love that race. Always a highlight of my year. That starts on Monday, April the 1st. And we'll move on to other news. Something which grabbed all of our attention, really, was the Col de Ratas record being broken. The Col de Ratas, a famous training climb on the Costa Blanca, close to Calpe, just inland from all those hotels that teams book out in January, December, and do their training camps. And the time up the Col de Ratas has become a bit of a sort of modern day Col de la Madone, hasn't it? A sort of indicator of form and riders to watch, and especially young riders. Well, you can go on YouTube and have a look. That was broken by a young Danish rider, 18 years old, Peter Erksenberg Hansen, I hope I've said that correctly, of Team Colquick. And Colquick kind of took it on like a double team time trial race effort. They had sponsors out there on the side ringing cowbells, and he beat the record. He beat Juan Ayuso, had the best on Strava up till the other day. He beat it by 11 seconds, 12:38. Significant, of course, because Jonas Vingegaard broke that record in 2018. And Daniel, well, you've been finding out a bit more about this, haven't you?
Yes, you mentioned the team, the Richard Colquick. It's a Danish Continental Division team. On Friday, I was on the way back from the beach, actually, and I had a call with their direct sportif, Christian Morbær, who is a friend of mine. He also works for Danish TV2 in the summer, but the rest of the year he's the Colquick DS, and he was orchestrating affairs, this Col de Ratas record attempt from the team car. Let's hear from Christian now.
There's many other climbs, mountains and so on in the world, but for us, for our cycling story, for this team is very important. Yes, also, we have learned a lot from the last two attempts with Jonas and Jakob Hinschout the year after. And we were also beating the KOM from Jonas the year after because of all this knowledge and know-how from how to do this. Like, it's even difficult to start at the right place, even that all 14 riders have bring all their best in the right position, right timing, right wattage. It's like spinning on a knife.
That was just a little bit of my conversation with Christian Morbær, and well, he told me about the lengths that Colquick went to on Friday to plan this record attempt. It's become partly because of the Vingegaard storyline in 2018, it's become part of this team's identity. And Richard, you mentioned they had sponsors there last week. It was sort of the sponsors' day, and the sponsors had ridden up the Col de Ratas beforehand. Christian had, well, they hadn't gone after the record for a few years, but he'd been sort of observing some of his riders' power files over the course of his training camp, and he thought that they were ready to take it on again. And they sort of devised this plan and went into an awful lot of detail about where each of their 14 riders were going to sort of sit in the pace line. In the past, Vingegaard, for example, when he broke it, he was the last man in the line, so 14th man, and they'd sort of studied things, and they'd studied how hard it was to kind of sprint out of the corners, and they decided that that wasn't the way forward, that their best guys should be sort of hidden more in the middle of the line. Vingegaard's record itself was broken by another Colo Quick rider, Jakob Hinsgaard, the following year, but for the next 3 or 4 years they hadn't attempted it, and that all sort of led to, as I say, Christian looking at the files this year and thinking we can go after this again, and also a use of having broken the record again. You can watch the video on YouTube. Now, the rider, the 18-year-old rider who broke the record, Peter Uxenberg Hansen, was not originally intended to be the anointed one. There were a couple of other riders who had been earmarked, Axel Beck, Scott Hansen, and Joshua Gudnitz, but it was Uxenberg Hansen who was the strongest on the day. Christian said, in the end, the final mark, 12 minutes 38 seconds, that equated to 455 watts over that time. Pretty impressive performance. Also impressive because Uxenberg Hansen wasn't even going to be part of the Colo Quick team this year. He's only 18 years old, and they felt that he was someone who needed a bit more experience at a lower level of racing, in spite of having incredible power numbers, incredible potential. But another rider who was earmarked for Colo Quick, Theodore Storm, was snapped up a few months ago by Ineos Grenadiers. That left a spot free. So in came Uxenberg Hansen, and he now has the record on the Coirates. Incidentally, this has become the Vingegaard story in 2018. Whether it was this that led to him getting the contract with Jumbo Visma has become a bit of an urban legend. There was a story about TJ Van Garderen, who previously had the record before Vingegaard, him having contacted Jumbo Visma and then having contacted Colo Quick. And as I said, it's been sort of surrounded, shrouded in mythology. I did ask Christian Murber about that, and this is what he said.
Many things to talk about in that story, but there was one day, one test that bring all the spotlights from World Cycling into this Colorado's KOM, because we beat TJ Van Garderen at that time, and yeah, we posted also the video, Instagram, and so on. And yeah, TJ Van Garderen wrote to us, and there was like some funny connections there, and our old sports director, Christian Andersen, he called Christian Niemann at the Jumbo that time, and then he was going to a test in Holland. And then after that, yeah, we know the story with the first contract and the double Tour de France. So it is, for us, it's special.
So there you go, chaps. New record holder on the Coirates. Mitch?
I got a couple of questions there. Did they have that time in mind? Did they want to do 12:38? Is that the record? Or did they want to do quicker than that? Like, were they like, oh, we actually thought we could have gone quicker? Or what was the plan going into that?
They had Ayuso's record at the forefront. Certainly Christian was basing the efforts, and you can see him in the video sort of shouting encouragement. They'd looked at all of his split times, I think, as well, at various points in the climb, and that was the mark that they were sort of gauging their effort.
And did Ayuso, when did he break it? He just broke it solo, just up there, two bottles in there, you know, just cruising up.
Yeah, if it wasn't solo, I would suggest that it wasn't planned to the same extent that this was. I suppose the comparison with Vingegaard is interesting, and certainly the Danish media. I mean, the Danish media has an appetite for cycling like no other one nation on earth, as we know, and this story has been huge in Denmark. So there's been a sort of forensic dissection of this performance compared to Vingegaard's performance. I mean, Christian Murberg said to me that Jonas Vingegaard did about the last 3 or 4 kilometers on his own. The rest of the team had peeled off pretty early in that instance. Here, Peter Oxenberg Hansen, he did about the last three 3.5 minutes on his own. So still very, very impressive. And obviously, he's a rider now who will be subject to, well, quite a lot of expectation and scrutiny, I would suggest, over the next couple of years.
I've got a funny, quick, funny story just before we break up there about taking comms. In Girona, there's a famous climb, Els Angels. You ride out of Girona. It starts, you'd only start it after 3 or 4K out of Girona, and everyone hits it up. It's a quite a flat climb. And this guy, a bit of an engine, Freddie Overt, he had the record up there. He's just very good at doing Strava.
Son of Freddie Overt, son of Peter
Overt. Exactly. He's an engine.
Peter Overt, sorry, Steve Overt.
Exactly, Peter, so the Steve runner. Overt.
Very, very, very famous.
And
runner.
He's got the engine, and for whatever reason, he just couldn't put it together to go world tour, but definitely has the physiology to go world tour. Held this record, and it bugged a lot of guys. And I know there was a group of guys that got together and went, that's it, we're taking this record off Overt. That's it, he can't have this record. And so they planned it out in such a way like this, but everyone, instead of riding up the hill, waited on a certain corner because they're like, well, I can't actually ride the whole way. So as they were coming, they got the yell and they would just pull, you know, some rip half a kilometer or a kilometer turn. And it was a group of friends of mine. And in the end, George Bennett got it in very similar fashion. It was just big guys like myself pulling the 1K turns on the flat climb and then just swinging out, you know. And credit to George, because he had to sit behind as everyone's ripping 500-600 watt turns.
I do fear for this record because Juan Ayuso is based near Calpe. So I would suggest that he will probably want his record back and may well take it.
Hello again, Lionel here. Very quickly with a word about Kilometer Zero and the 1101 Cappuccino, because we do get a few questions from listeners about how the two different subscriptions work. First of all, friends of the podcast subscribers get access to the Kilometer Zero feed of more than 140 special episodes recorded over the years. The most recent was my 5-part series recorded at last year's Milan-San Remo. And I know that Daniel's got an episode in the pipeline as we speak. Now, an annual subscription as a friend of the podcast gets access to all of those Kilometer Zero episodes, plus the entire Kilometer Zero back catalogue recorded at the Grand Tours between 2015 and 2019. We'll be releasing one new Kilometer Zero episode every month for friends of the podcast subscribers. And to sign up, go to thecyclingpodcast.com. On the other hand, the 1101 Cappuccino is a free email sent out roughly weekly or thereabouts, and at the moment I'm writing a series, The Whimsical Guide to the Classics. The next instalment of that, The Whimsical Guide to the Tour of Flanders, will be out before the weekend. Hopefully you've been enjoying reading that. The most recent one was The Whimsical Guide to Gent-Wevelgem and Other Races. To subscribe, go to thecyclingpodcast.substack.com. And once you've subscribed, the 1101 Cappuccino will drop into your inbox without you having to do anything. It's completely free. We'll also be sending an email as soon as the Arrivé episodes are online over the next few weeks as well. So the quickest way to listen to our Arrivé episodes after the classics will most likely be to do so when the email drops into your inbox. Now, there is an option to support us financially via Substack if you want to. But I do want to just make clear that this is totally separate to the Friend of the Podcast subscription. You don't get access to those Kilometer Zero episodes. It's a different platform and it's totally optional. You don't have to support us financially via the 1101 Cappuccino. You don't have to sign up as a Friend of the Podcast either, of course. Both are entirely optional, but all of your support does go a long way to helping us to plan a full season of coverage. Of course, the Giro d'Italia is not long away now, and the Cycling Podcast will be there on the ground covering the race from beginning to end, as we will with the Tour de France and the Vuelta a España, of course. So hopefully that's cleared that up. If you do have any queries, drop us a line. The email address is contact@thecyclingpodcast.com. Now, I've waffled on more than enough here. Back to Daniel and the rest of the episode.
Well, chaps, as Richard said, we're very much in Holy Week of Belgian cycling. We certainly are now, if we weren't last week. Well, E3 and Gent-Wevelgem, a cracking start to the most important period, certainly as far as the spring classics were concerned. And I wouldn't say that we saw too many surprises. We maybe saw some micro surprises, but the bottom line was pretty, well, widely anticipated, in the sense that Mathieu van der Poel comes out of the weekend, the E3 Gent-Wevelgem weekend, with his stock as high, if not higher, than it was at the start of the season. Maybe Visma Lisa bike slightly sort of diminished in some people's eyes. And Mads Pedersen having emerged as, well, if not the number one outsider, then I would say one of the men most likely to challenge Van der Poel in Flanders at the weekend. But Mitch, E3 and Gent-Wevelgem, your big takeaways, please.
Gent-Wevelgem, I loved Mads leading that sprint out. It was an epic day. The way he led that out, the confidence he showed, I don't know if anyone could really do that. Like, you know, as we know with Van der Poel, he's not slow. We've seen him go toe-to-toe with Van Aert coming into Flanders and finishing him off in the same situation. So to have that confidence after such a day, I started to think, where's he getting that confidence from? If you rewind it back to E3, if you look at the whole race of Gent-Wevelgem as well, it's got to come from that team. The team, for me, Trek, is just oozing confidence the way they're riding as a team. You pointed out in the news roundup, they not only had three guys in that small front group in Gent-Wevelgem, when you looked back at this peloton behind, they also had another four guys in that small group behind. They had seven guys of eight in the front part of the race. What team does that anymore? You know, maybe Visma in the opening weekend, we saw the dominance there. The old of Quickstep, we used to see that. It was really cool to see that. And in E3, they didn't come away with it. Jasper second in the end. They rode really well. They controlled both of those races. And they're the team. They're the classics team. That was my big takeaway from it. I know it's a very obvious takeaway from it, but the way Milan rode, he set up Pedersen for that easy ride, you could say, in a way. And, you know, ultimately, he still had to win it against Van der Poel in a really tough way. And listening to his interview afterwards, I was actually wondering why he let it out from so far, why he kept so much speed, why he didn't put a bit more pressure on Van der Poel leading it out. And he alluded to it that, yeah, you know what, they had Philipsen behind. I couldn't take the chance that, you know, Van der Poel would just sit up and wait for Philipsen and we'd all come back together. And I was like, oh, that's actually a really good point. Whether that would have happened or not, I don't know, because Van der Poel probably could have played that card a hell of a lot earlier if that was the case. You know, he didn't need to be chasing Milan early on for 20, 30 kilometers when there was still 100 kilometers to go in the race. So I don't know whether that was true, but it was a really good point. And at the end of the day, he told himself, I need to be confident to win this sprint. I need to believe that I can win from the front. It was really quite cool, quite a cool interview to listen to. If you listen to that after Gent-Wevelgem, I'd recommend to go back and listen to Pedersen's interview, and you can just feel the confidence there. He wasn't arrogant in a way. He's ready to go for Flanders. I think because of this win, not only because of the form, but because of the mentality, because of the group around them, Trek, he, for me, is really going to be tough to beat there.
Is it Het Nieuwsblad or Het Laatste Nieuws? Their takeaway from the weekend was commenting on exactly what you've said, Mitch, that Little Trek was so strong, but comparing them to Quickstep, saying that the way they rode and the way they're probably going to ride in Flanders is how Quickstep would have rode of old, you know? A team that's got four guys probably that could win it. It's really just a case of which one is the one that makes the move or gets in the break that stays away.
Also, you can look at what Pedersen did. He was not there at opening weekend. He showed that form in the early races in France, missed the opening weekend strategically, and they've come in fresh, mentally, physically. I think that's a big element leading into Flanders and also on from there to Roubaix. That's going to be the element where the Visma can bounce back. And I know Van Aert's taken a break and come back down. He'll need Waregem this week on Wednesday to sharpen himself up for Flanders. And Van der Poel supposedly is not going to do Waregem or Dwars de Vlaanderen this week to freshen up. So, look, there's all different ways to attack it. And at the end of all this, in hindsight, we'd be like, oh, of course that was right the way they did it. But it'd be interesting to see what happens now.
Mitch, just on Pedersen, one thing that really strikes me and I think strikes other people about him is how decisive and how committed he is, and how this has a sort of galvanizing effect, or it seems to from the outside, a galvanizing effect on the rest of his team. In interviews, it won't have passed unnoticed, and I think more and more, I noticed the Italian Eurosport commentators are commenting on this more and more this year. It can come across as pretty abrasive because he is so direct. And again, it can come across as arrogant sometimes, but he makes no bones about the fact that, well, when he's feeling good or when he wants to win, and he's not going to waver. I actually asked him at Paris-Nice whether he finds it on days where he has a chance to win, whether he finds it more useful to be open-minded and reactive to situations, or to have a really sort of well-defined plan and to commit. And he sort of that was one occasion actually when he did kind of vacillate slightly, and he said, well, sometimes you do have to be open-minded. But it seems to me that this is a guy who, in the bus every morning or before the start of every race that he thinks he can win, really commits in such a way that the rest of the team really commits as well. And, you know, I think about Sudal Quickstep and the issues that they've been having the last couple of years. They have gone into races, I feel, with a much more kind of open-minded approach. Obviously, you have to have the legs as well, but they've had three or four different candidates for victory, as against, you know, Pedersen at San Remo. And we saw and we heard in the interviews before that race, he said, if I am feeling good on the top of the Poggio, we are riding for me. And he almost seems to me that he's a bit of a player manager as well as a team captain. I mean, what effect does that have in a team when you have a rider who is that committed and decisive and clear in their messaging to the rest of the riders as well in the team?
I would 100% agree with you. And when you look through Quickstep's lineup, you got Lampard, Alaphilippe, Askren, Pedersen, like, you know, Moscon. Who are these guys that are oozing that kind of sort of confidence and authority there? They're very handy riders, don't get me wrong, but I've never got that feeling from their personalities, exactly what you explained. And you think of the old, you know, the Tom Boonens, even when you think of Gilbert when he was on Quickstep, they've got this sort of presence about them. And I don't feel that with Sudal Quickstep. So I 100% agree with you with Pedersen. He's sort of got this directness. I've never been in one of the team meetings, and I'd love to know exactly what it's like. But I get the feeling exactly what you said. Even when in that same interview I'm talking about, he spoke about going up the backside of the Koppenberg. The Camelberg. Yeah, I wanted to go to the front, not because I wanted to attack, because I wanted to control the pace. You know, just that real directness, and even saying that in the interview, I love hearing stuff like that. It's not often you get that kind of insight in interviews. He wasn't afraid to say what he was doing. You know, often you get those wishy-washy interviews, you know, the 100% and all this sort of crap that you can't even be bothered hearing. That doesn't tell you anything. Pedersen's interview was very insightful, I felt. And I get the feeling exactly what you said in the bus. He would say, and I've had the feeling from another Dane, you know, Magnus Cort Nielsen, very direct. In a lead-out situation, they were insinuating that maybe I wouldn't get over the climb to lead Magnus out. Maybe we'll use another guy. And he just stopped the meeting straight then and there and said, no, I want Mitch to be the lead out man. And all of a sudden I was like, holy shit, I've got to get over this climb. But it gave me confidence. I don't know whether it's a Danish thing.
The other day, Rob Hatch, I said I'm house sitting for him. And we were talking about, I was sort of ranting to him about French commentary on races. In the course of any broadcast, you will get the French commentators, they'll name a rider and they'll go, oh, pourquoi pas? Why not? And that kind of, to me, that sums up French cycling, and it sums up exactly what we're not talking about. This kind of wishy-washy idea that, well, pourquoi pas? Why can't he win? Oh, why can't he win? He might have a chance. And that explains, I feel it explains a lot about the way French riders have ridden historically, you know, firing off down the road at sort of indefinite times in races, just on a whim, seemingly.
I've been told that. I've been told that by a French director. early in my days, I was riding on a French team. He's like, just attack, just attack. I'm like, I'm waiting for the sprint. No, attack. I'm like, this is the worst thing I can do. I can definitely win in the sprint from a group of four. Attack. You know, let's see what happens. Totally.
The Mads Pedersen approach is definitely an antidote to the pourquoi pas school of professional cycling. But, you know, you saw two very decisive riders together in Gent-Wevelgem, didn't you? Mads Pedersen and Mathieu van der Poel. And so often we see, even it's just a few seconds of hesitation, that's all it needs for the race to come back together and for us to see a completely different scenario. But in that instance, we saw two riders who were completely committed. Van der Poel maybe, some might say wrong, because had he maybe been a bit more open-minded and thought about a different scenario in the race, thought about Jasper Philipsen behind, then it may have come back together and that might have worked out well for Alpecin de Koenig. But let's talk a bit about Van der Poel, what we saw from him, particularly in E3 and then in Wevelgem at the weekend. He was obviously a little bit tired in Gent-Wevelgem, and you know, I wanted to ask you, Mitch, as well about this combination of the two races, the Friday and the Sunday, and implications for the following weekend. Are there any? Is that a risk? Van Aert sat out Sunday, and as I say, we saw a bit of accumulated tiredness in Van der Poel on Sunday.
I don't think it's anything to do with the following Sunday. I don't know if that accumulated fatigue will affect the following Sunday. I think probably Van Aert has probably got a strategic plan coming down from altitude to have, you know, strategic hit outs. Like I said, if he's going to ride Dwars de Vlaanderen on Wednesday, doing E3, Gent-Wevelgem, Dwars de Vlaanderen, Flanders, that maybe is too much. You know, like, of course, the rest of us have to do that. But for the top guys who are trying to win these races, that's probably too much. So he was just like, cool, I can't do it all. I definitely want to have two hit outs. I don't want them to be back-to-back. And that's the tactic he went for. In terms of those two races, two very, very different races, you can't compare those two races in terms of the style of racing. Yes, there is cobblestones. There is this, you know, the short, sharp climb once you hit to the Camelberg. But everything else is a totally different race. It's a lot about, you know, riding the whole time on that threshold all day in the crosswinds. I'm talking about Gent-Wevelgem now. E3 is closer to a Flanderen race. You can't even compare those two races, really, because E3 is just, it's all on. It's tits out. Everyone's just smashing over these climbs. The next thing you know, it's over. So it is a very full-on race, E3. It's all about that effort recovery, smashing over those climbs, you know, get ready for the next one, positioning. And Wevelgem's sort of like a... Mentally, I sort of loved, again, Wevelgem, because it was a break from all that. You know, you do Dwars of Flanders, and you do Flanders. It's just, you're going around in circles in the Flanders region. You get to Gent-Wevelgem, you feel like you're going point to point. You're swapping off in those echelons. So it is a different effort, but psychologically it's different as well. I feel like being in different groups, coming back together, hitting the Camelberg, and then moving away from the hill zone, heading to the finish. So look, in a long way around it, I think the combination, yes, is physically taxing, of course, but I think, in my opinion, the way Van der Poel rode in Gent-Wevelgem didn't help that fatigue he was holding from the day before. I feel like he could have done things differently. He did not need, in my opinion, to sit on the front and chase Milan back for that 20 or 30K. He potentially could have got help from those other guys there, you know, Pithay and the other couple of guys that were there as well. Whether he was asking them for it or whether they just couldn't do it, I don't know. I never saw him swing the elbow or really get any help. Seemed like he was just pretty happy just to chase it back on his own. I don't know. I just don't know really what his tactic was there and why he didn't just, like I said, sit up and put the pressure back on Trek, because they also had numbers back there, Alpecin.
Have chaps we seen the blueprint to beat Van der Poel, though, particularly on Sunday with Little Trek and their numerical strength, their numerical advantage? The way Alpecin de Koenig seems to be approaching these races, and this is it's a result, this is a consequence of the resources they have. They use sort of three or four riders to position Van der Poel early in the race and make sure he's, you know, in good shape when we get to the last 100 kilometres. And then we've seen sort of Søren Krogh Andersen, who's, I suppose, well, along with Philipsen, he's their sort of second string or deputy. And then he often does a good job sort of marking moves in that phase, maybe between 100 kilometers to go and 60 kilometers to go. But Van der Poel, he's pretty exposed at that point, and he's overcome that isolation by, well, with his strength and taking matters into his own hands. But is that a bit of a weakness, chaps? Do you think that he might be exposed pretty early, and particularly if Trek do have numbers and other teams might have numbers with 60, 70 kilometres to go, is that where he could be vulnerable?
I think, you know, Flanders is just a completely different game. I do believe we're going to have Visma with numbers in the front as well. Maybe that was the element at Gent-Wevelgem that we didn't see due to, you know, crashes and also Van Aert not being there. But regardless of Van der Poel, I think that, you know, it is an obvious thing to say. Numbers in the front gives you that advantage, gives you options, and you can always play that advantage. So it is a very obvious thing to say, yes, that is the way to sort of isolate Van der Poel, and it's a way to sort of beat him. It's the only way, maybe. But I think that's the way you got to go about, whether we're talking about Van der Poel, whether we're talking about Van Aert, any of these kinds of sort of riders. It's just playing that number and making them feel like they have to cover every move and using up the extra energy that they have over the other riders, it seems.
One aspect where Flanders does differ, especially from E3, what was it from the Quaremont? It's got about 50k to the finish of Harebeke. So that was what Van der Poel was soloing. In the Tour of Flanders, those two climbs, the Oude Quaremont and then Paterberg, are much closer to the finish, aren't they? And that's what I kind of thought about E3 when I was watching it, was how early it detonated. You know, it was sort of 100 kilometres, 90 kilometres to go. I guess that was partly because of where the climbs were positioned, but the tactical approach to Flanders seems to be that, you know, you are waiting for those final two climbs, because people always, you know, history and the parkour dictates that that's where it's going to go down. It's rare. I don't think, has it ever happened where a rider's been away prior to those last two climbs and stayed away? I'm not sure that it has. If it has, I can't remember. So I wonder whether teams will try and expose Van der Poel before those climbs. You know, if they wait until the last time up the Quaremont and Paterberg, well, he's proved he's the strongest guy in the field at the moment. If you do have numbers, if you're Visma Lisa bike, if you are Little Trek, you've got to be thinking, how are we going to be making Van der Poel do these efforts with 90k to go, 100k to go? That's going to mean that when it does come down to those last climbs, he doesn't have that kind of turbo that he's. I mean, I don't know. Is this the best form you've seen Van der Poel in? I'm not sure I've seen him go solo for that long like he did in E3. There seems to be this kind of aura around him that you sometimes get with these best classics riders in at this time of year, like Boonen had it, Cancellara had it in those years when they were winning all sorts. That sort of like aura of like indestructibility a little bit, that, you know, they're not getting mechanicals, they're not getting flats. It's almost like they're carrying luck as well around with them. I think he's definitely got that kind of charisma or that sort of center of gravity, you know, almost around him.
Yeah, I think, I mean, I said to you chaps before we started recording today, I think that over the last 3 or 4 years, he's definitely refined his process and refined his sort of race craft. And there were times early in his road career or in his road-focused career when he looked a little bit naive at times in San Remo, for example, with his positioning. And no one really talks about that anymore, that any trace of naivety. There were some times where he used a sort of a hammer when it felt as though he could have been using a kind of penknife at times. There was a lack of sort of subtlety to his approach, and I think that's gone. The other thing I think, Mitch, and Richard, is that there are a lot of riders who will be trying to win Flanders at the weekend for whom it feels kind of existential, like a bit of a matter of life and death. And this is partly because of what they've said in interviews. For example, Pedersen himself has said, I have to win a monument this year, and it feels as though he's put a lot of pressure on it. Van Aert, we all know, and we'll probably talk about that again a bit later, we all know about the narrative that's been created there, that he's condemned to win Flanders or Paris-Roubaix, otherwise his career will be, I mean, it's ridiculous to say, but his career or his season will be viewed as a failure. I feel that Van der Poel is riding like a guy who's completely liberated of all those expectations, any expectations that he's putting on that he might put on himself. He's not saying in interviews, I want to be the best or win more Flanders than Merckx or Eric LeMond or I want to be the best classics rider of all time. He's just kind of doing his thing. And he's willing to risk losing, and we saw that in Gent-Wevelgem on Sunday, and I think that is a real weapon as well that he has.
Yeah, totally. You've really pointed a really good point out there. You do feel that pressure around, and I don't necessarily maybe around Pedersen now. It's eased a little bit. I know Wevelgem's not a monument, but he will go into Flanders with a little less pressure. But I definitely feel that pressure around Van Aert, being a Belgian. He just seems like he's always so close to winning so much. I know he wins a lot too, but I would love to just have a look at all the second places and great sort of results that he's got that could have been amazing wins as well. So I'm feeling that, definitely that pressure around Van Aert. I don't know that for sure, but I'm feeling that. I'm feeling that more than, say, Mads. Yeah, it's got to play a toll.
I don't know how much you can read into the body language after 170k of E3, but you know, watching that chase with Van Aert and Van der Poel, you've got Van der Poel up front looking tired, but looking sort of energized. And Van der Poel just 15 seconds back, but looked tired, looked like he had this weight on his shoulders, looked almost sort of like he was chasing, but he almost sort of knew he was defeated in a way. There was, I don't know, the contrast in body language. I think there was a point when Van Aert was riding without his glasses on as well. A team car came up and handed him some sunnies because it had started raining. And he looked like a guy who, you know, wasn't kind of on that cloud nine kind of place where you want to be in the classics. He wasn't pinging, was he?
We're deep into journalistic armchair quarterback soft factor stuff here. Love this.
I love this also. This is like seriously famous last words, because like we can't forget that Van Aert crashed, was off his bike at the bottom of the Paterberg, which is like a seriously steep climb. It was at 0 kilometers an hour and is somehow over the top afterwards in the front and going off the front of that group. Like that just got completely under, you know, no one even spoke about that, how ridiculously hard that move was to get back on the bike, catch back up, then still attack. So his form's still there. I'm still backing him. I'm gonna go Van Aert for Flanders. I don't know if we're getting into predictions yet, but I just thought that'd be nice to bring it up.
So we're gonna pivot for a minute in part three, at the start of part three, and we will resume our sort of speculation prognostication about Flanders after that. It's the big one on Sunday afternoon, Manchester City against, I mean, the Tour of Flanders on Sunday afternoon. I need to work out a way to record our Arrivé episode that doesn't clash with kickoff on Sunday afternoon, but that's my problem. One that I'll be working hard on. I'll be working hard to resolve over the next few days. Tour of Flanders on Sunday. Now, chaps, we haven't got the definitive start list yet, but we're pretty sure what EF Education First's lineup is going to look like. And there's a rider who will be in their starting seven, I believe, who is very intriguing in that Sunday and Tour of Flanders will represent the sort of the end or a very important waypoint on a long and, well, for him, kind of tortuous, but in other ways, life-affirming or life sort of restoring journey. That rider is Michael Valgren, the Danish rider. And Richard, you spoke to him a couple of days ago about an injury that he suffered in 2002, the Route Occitanie, an injury that looked at one stage as though it was going to cost him his career. He came back to racing last year, originally in the EF Education, their development team, effectively their Pro Conti team, and over the last few months he's slowly made his way back to the sort of, well, the upper tier of the sport and the World Tour, so much so that he will be riding in Flanders on Sunday. That rider is Michael Valgren. I said he had a terrible injury in 2022, broke his pelvis, dislocated his hip, had knee issues. Let's hear, shall we, about his comeback and some of the difficulties that he's faced. And, well, this will put in perspective for us, I think, just what Sunday will mean for Valgren.
It was really bad. If you first hear the things, the problems I had, I'd say my doctors were not sure I would ever come back to riding my bike, you know, at the highest level. Of course, they didn't tell me about it. They told my wife, but she never told me. I just kept believing, you know, in that I would come back, because my physio was really like, yeah, Mike, you're going to come back. No worries, I'll fix you. All this, you know. And so I just kept working really hard. Then I ran into a lot of complications. Basically, the first month was all right. But then after that, the next four was just horrible. I just didn't move an inch. The pain didn't go away. I didn't get any better. Did a second or third surgery in the knee as well. And it's just really, really baby steps. I know, like, a recovery, it's not like a linear graph, you know. It's like a bit of up and down, but I feel like mine was just down. Really, really tough period for me, but also for my family. Like, I think, you know, like, I was not the same Michael as I used to be, so my wife could feel that, and I was trying to be happy, like, putting on a facade, you know, but at the end of the day, and deep inside, I was just miserable, you know. I was just taking away my passion, you know. This is not the way I wanted to stop my career. So that's also something that actually kept me going. Like, I wanted to stop on my own terms, make my own choices. If you can do that, I think you're lucky, you know. And but I wanted to fight for that. So, and luckily, you say almost 2 years after, here I am racing the biggest one-day races of the calendar. You know, I'm in the game. You know, I'm not just a passenger. I'm a piece of the puzzle, I would say. So for at least for my team, you know. So I'm really happy to be back, and it's been a lot of hard work to come here, but I'm here now.
I mean, that you talked there about the kind of character you were and the sort of person you were. I guess that's often a side of recovery or rehab that isn't talked about as much, and it's not as easy to, or it's not as perhaps as structured as a physical recovery. You know, you can train, you can have a training plan, you can have a physio plan, but when you're having to deal with that sort of psychological side of thing and you know, who you are as a human and how you are around other people when you don't have, you know, your career and your sort of passion, you know, available to you, that's a hard thing to deal with, isn't it? And there's no easy answer or clear sort of pathway to get
for sure
that,
not,
find
like,
that again.
It can go both ways, right? I think for many guys, even for myself, I think this could easily end up in some sort of depression. Luckily, like, my wife, she's an educated psychologist, and I'm not sure if it would have done any different, made any difference if she wasn't, but I think she really handled this situation really well. As my wife, as my partner, and as my best friend, but also as my shrink, you know. I even had a sports psychologist during this time as well. I was working with one for a year and a half before even the crash, so he also got me through this. All in all, I just had a really good team behind me, like my family, my team, my friends. I was pretty open about it, about how I felt, you know, and I think that really got me through it a lot better instead of dealing with it all myself. So I think that's an advice I would give to people. Like, if you go through tough times, really find someone to talk to it about, and you know, you can be honest, because it really just relieves so much from your chest, you know, like, if you can be honest and come out with it. So I think for me, that was really, really, really important.
Did you expect that you'd be giving interviews about it for quite as long as you have been? It's the sort of such a big part of your story over the last few years, but I imagine it's sort of, I mean, Groundhog Day is maybe doesn't quite do it justice, but perhaps not something you were expecting. I don't know.
I didn't actually. I thought, yeah, when it happened, I was sure people liked to hear the story, blah blah blah, and then also when or if I could come back, then it would also be like a good story, but. Yeah, now it's almost a year ago since I did the first race after the crash. And every time I go to a race, someone asks me about it, you know. And last year in Tour of Denmark, I said, like, can we please stop calling it, like, a comeback? You know, like, I think now I'm actually I'm back to my level. I'm back where I want to be. It's not a comeback anymore. And let's just focus on the future, you know. I think it is a really good story, and I think maybe I don't know myself how big an achievement this might be to come back from these kind of injuries, you know, and to get back to this level. Many people have been telling me, like, oh, Michael, what you did is amazing. Not many guys can go through this, blah, blah, blah. And I'm like, yeah, you just, it's something you just have to say, right? But maybe it's true, you know. But for me, it's just really natural. I was never, like, thinking about giving up. But at the same time, I think if it was about to happen again, then I'm probably not sure I could make it through it again. At least not at the same speed, you know, but yeah. Hopefully I can stay on the bike for the rest of my career.
The peloton is made up of riders who have gone through perhaps something similar, who have come back, who are still coming back. And I guess maybe something that you all have in common is that you're trying to rediscover something, whether that's results or even just a feeling. I mean, I think maybe you touched on it a little bit just earlier about that sense of not just being a passenger in a race, but being an actor and being able to have a role in these races. I mean, was that what really you've been looking for in this process?
Well, when you're in it, like when you're in your rehab, you just want to get better. You just want to get healthy and fit again. Especially in my case, because I couldn't do a pedal stroke for the first almost 6 months, you know. And for me to be able to do my job, I had to kind of do pedal strokes, you know. So finally, when I could do that after 6 months, I could start to train again. That's when I maybe started to change my perspective of things. Like, okay, now I have to come back to a good level. And then I came back to a good level. And I was, okay, now I'd like to do something for the team. I'm there now. And now I think the next step for me is I would like to try and get a result. That's what I'm still chasing. And I still believe I have it in me. I'm just happy that I'm able to compete it at the highest races. And actually, like I said before, or I could be someone who could be the last guy for some of my teammates, or I could be the one that I'm getting a result. You know, I really still believe I have the ability. And as long as I have that belief, I will keep fighting. I'll keep do my best. I'll keep training as much as I do and do all the right things. And then I think one day it'll just all click. And yeah, then I think we'll have a really, really good story. Then the circle is finished, you know, with this crash kind of thing. Then we have been around the whole spectrum, you know. So that would be the perfect way to end the story somehow, you know.
And draw a line under it and not have to answer any more questions about it. I'm curious though about the classics in particular, because you know you're kind of back at the Belgian classics, at least the Cobble classics, for the first time since 2022, and these are races that are inherently risky. I guess you know that you could crash, whether that's something quite innocuous or by accident, but you sort of have to be, as a rider, I guess, aware of that risk, but maybe able to shut it out. And I wonder how your experience in the peloton, rubbing elbows on these narrow Flemish windswept cobbled roads is different now to how it was a couple of years ago.
Yeah, for me, actually, I don't know why this has happened, but I've been super lucky regarding this after my crash. I've had no problems whatsoever with going into a position fight. Actually, I have to say, I think I've become a lot better on it since my crash. Yeah, I think for me, it didn't change much. For me, it was also kind of different. Like, you know, my crash was on a descent, and I know it was my own fault. Does that make sense? Like, it was not because I was fighting at a position fight or boxing with someone. It was just me going way too fast downhill. It was nothing to do with the material. It was just a mistake, if you can say that like that. So even going downhill now and positioning and all this stuff, it hasn't changed at all since and before and after the crash, actually. So that was pretty good. You know, I remember a little bit in the beginning when I was going downhill, I was a little bit scared, but then I did actually some kind of a bit of a funny thing. I was doing some goggles I put on, like VR. It was supposed to erase my memory somehow. I did a few sessions of that, and like it didn't erase my memory because I obviously remember everything, but somehow I think deep inside my brain or whatever, it did work with something, you know. So that's quite quite interesting, actually.
What was that, the VR thing? Was that part of the rehab sort of psychological side of things, mental side of things?
It was someone from the team who brought it up. Our chiropractor, our head of Kairos, Matt Raven. So he works in football in the UK, and I think they maybe did it at his team and stuff like this, you know. So he brought it to me at the training camp. I put the goggles on and I came into this empty cinema. I had to close my eyes, imagine the crash for me, and then suddenly the cinema would go into like just a blue screen, and it'd be like a ball going from side to side, going like tick tock, tick tock. I had to follow this ball with my eyes, and then they would disappear, and then I would suddenly be in the mountains with bird noises and waterfalls. And I had to like look at some whatever, and you know, and really focus on that, and then I had to think five things from the crash, and I come back to the cinema, and again the same thing happened, and that just kept going on for like half an hour. I had to think of different things. It was a bit weird. Some of it worked for sure, but I cannot say exactly what it did, but it did something.
So you'd put on these big VR goggles, and then the session, how long would the session last where you'd be sort of doing that, visualizing things?
Like half an hour. And I had to do it for like, I think it was minimum 4 days in a row, just the same session, you know. And I remember the last day, it was harder for me to visualize my crash, actually what happened, you know. So there was for sure something working, you know. I think it was this ball that was going from side to side. I was kind of like, you know, erasing my memories. I don't know. But yeah, it was quite interesting.
So they're using that in professional football then? Had you heard of that being used in pro cycling before? I've never heard of that at all before now.
Never. I think it's like some kind of like experiment Matt was thinking, you know. I'm not even sure where he got it from. But he just brought it to me at the training camp last year in January, because I think many guys on the team were nervous for me, from how I would descend, you know. But I was like saying to them, no, I'll be fine, I'm fine. But let's at least try and help you, you know. So Matt came up with this idea, and it's hard to say if I would still be the same as I am now without this VR thing, but for sure it was interesting, for sure.
A really fascinating interview there that you did, Richard, with Michael Valgren. Of course, a rider who, well, not too long ago, was someone who would have been considered one of the favourites for the Tour of Flanders. And Richard, we didn't hear all of your conversation there, but he certainly still has those ambitions to be very much in the mix among the best riders in races like Flanders. Of course, he won Amstel Gold in 2018, won Het Nieuwsblad as well in 2018. As I said, sort of slowly working his way back to the top echelons of classics racing. But what a fascinating interview, Richard.
Yeah, the thing that I had no idea about, I mean, Michael's given a lot of interviews actually about the recovery, and I think he was a little bit... I have to talk about this again. He's obviously keen to put it behind him, but something that I'd not heard about before was this use of virtual reality to sort of overcome some of the psychological barriers that you maybe carry with you, as well as the physical scars when you come back from something like that. But Daniel, you said you'd got some experience of VR rehab.
Yeah, not VR. So the process, as far as I could understand, I actually asked, well, Michael Valgren spoke there about Matt Rabin, the EF education, the chiropractor. It was a sort of combination of VR and something else called EMDR, which stands for eye movement, desensitization and reprocessing. It's a trauma therapy, and without going into too much detail, I've got some experience of that. It's quite a well-known sort of method. It's an alternative method. It was developed in the late 80s by a lady called Francine Shapiro, and it's called eye movement desensitization and reprocessing. And basically it's a little bit like hypnosis, in the sense that often what will happen is the practitioner will sort of wave something in front of your eyes, and as your eyes move from left to right, and previously you'd have been talking about or thinking about a traumatic event, that this seems to have the effect of kind of replacing a traumatic memory. And it's well known to work very well with sort of single traumatic events. It doesn't work quite so well with sort of a series of traumatic events, or, you know, long periods of trauma or stress. And to be honest, it didn't really work for me. It's one of those things where you can become quite self-conscious because it does seem odd. You know, the thought that a major event in your the memory, or and a sort of debilitating memory of a major event or major events in your life are going to just be erased or replaced by someone waving a finger or a pen, or tapping is another way in which it's done, sort of tapping your hands. If you don't really believe that it is going to work, then I would suggest it probably isn't going to work. And in my case, it didn't really work. But as I say, it doesn't surprise me that for a single traumatic event, like a crash, like a cycling crash, and, you know, for car crashes, it's often used as well, that it seems to have worked for Michael Valgren.
I can remember, I mean, it wasn't in a race, but I, a few years ago, cycled into the back of a car, completely my own fault. and you know, I had a bit of injuries and stuff to kind of recover from after that. And I got back to riding after a couple of months or so. And the thing that struck me more than feeling sort of physically unfit was that I had this sense of how everything was so hard. Like the physical hardness of everything around me was so clear in my mind when I was riding around. It was very strange, but it was looking at objects, other cars, and just overwhelmed by the sense that these were huge 2-ton objects made of metal. And that was one of the biggest kind of things to get over, like, I think was that sense. And that was kind of what I was getting at, I guess, when I spoke to Michael. But it seems like, I don't know, Mitch, pro racers are a slightly different breed in some senses. Maybe the risk sense of their brains are slightly differently formed, but no real kind of, yeah, I guess much less lingering kind of issues there for Michael's case, getting back racing so quickly.
I've got two sides to it now, not being in the peloton. When I was in the peloton, I think it would be great to erase that and just sort of push on. But now I'm thinking, like, why do you want to erase that? There's a reason why you've got that trauma there, so you don't put yourself in that situation again, you know, and to just sort of get back in there and forget all about it. And yeah, it's, I can't understate how crazy these races really are. I know all races are crazy, but I mean, these ones in Belgium, I was just reminded about it the other day, watching these races and the risks you just take, you force yourself to do. And you don't actually, force is not the right word. When you start forcing yourself to do it, it's over. Your career's over. You're just doing it because that's where you need and want to be. So to be able to erase that out of your mind is the best thing that could have happened for him. I know his crash wasn't to do with, you know, the classics per se, but that trauma, I think, I don't know, myself having a big crash, I don't know whether that did have an effect on me. I felt like I got over it. Who knows? Did it have an underlying effect, and that later on affects me in my last few years and not really wanting to be up at the classics? Haven't really thought of it like that. But it's an interesting tactic. I found it very, very interesting hearing about it. And just probably the more interesting thing that I found interesting, more interesting out of that was the comeback, the finishing on his own terms, the support he got from his wife. And I related a lot to that, and understanding how invested everyone has to be in your own career as a pro. I totally underestimated that until I retired and realized that, hey, everyone was on the Mitch Docker show. And it was like that. And everyone's on the Michael Valgren show. They've got to be, because that's the way you got to live to be an athlete. You've got to be so selfish, and everyone's got to be sort of supporting you. And we do this now and we do that now. And so when you're down, everyone feels you're down. And I really related to that. And I really heard in his voice how important his wife was to him for that comeback, and how important that comeback was for the family.
We'll talk about the Mitch Docker show in a minute. And Michael Valgren was actually, he got the Talking Luff treatment, didn't he? I listened to that yesterday, Mitch, re-listened to that. It was actually fascinating to hear him talk about how inspired he'd been by the CSC documentary Overcoming way back in sort of 2004. Just on the issue of trauma, incidentally, I had an interesting conversation with Larry Warbass a couple of weeks ago when I was in Ayers, when I was at his home. We were talking about the trauma of going deep in races, and Mitch, you said there about how you wouldn't want to necessarily erase traumatic memories because they can be sort of learnt, the teachable moments, in the sense that you learn never to go to those places again, and they help preserve your existence effectively. Exactly. Larry and I were talking about the experience of going very, very deep in races, going sort of those few days in your career when you do feel as though your life is almost in danger, that you're hurting yourself so much on the bike. And he was sort of wondering about the kind of mental scar tissue of those experiences, whether it is, as your career goes on, as the years go on, whether it is hard to go back to that place, because again, they are putting you, well, your body feels as though it's being put in danger.
I agree with you. I agree with Larry, because look at a guy like, and I know there's a lot of young guys, but the one that stands out right now is Laurence Pithet. He's at this beautiful part of his career where he's just exploring how deep to go. What can I do? What can't I do? Who knows? I'll just hit this climb and hang on for as long as I want. This mental scar tissue is not there yet. And as you become older as a pro, I say ceilings. You build these ceilings in your own sort of world where you go, I'm not going there again. I don't want to go there. I've tried that before. It hurt. It didn't make it. Whatever it is. So it does restrict you in a way. And as a young guy, you're always exploring that and finding out what those limits are and maybe going too far and almost killing yourself, not literally, but you know what I mean. And it is funny that it's maybe not as dramatic as we're making it, but at the end of your career, people say that, I've only got so many matches in the match box, I'm not going to burn all of them out training. You know, that was what we used to say. Why would I do that out training? I'll save them for the races. I need those mental matchsticks for the races. And once they're all gone, they're all gone. I definitely feel that now as a retired rider. People go, you going to go to that road race just up the road from you tomorrow? Yeah. And I'm like, why would I do that? They're gone. I've got no more matches left.
Then I've also heard that the other side of things, which is that, you know, when riders retire, they don't find those situations in post racing life that offer them those opportunities to go that deep, you know, to that point. I mean, Mitch, you're saying it like not literally dying, but that's kind of what you're asking your body to do. You're putting it through so much effort that it's your governor and parts of your brain and parts of your body are basically telling you, if you keep doing this, you will die. Like, your body will stop functioning. That's kind of what that feeling is when you go that deep, isn't it? But, you know, you hear anecdotally, and I don't know how much this is true for you, but riders can get addicted to that feeling as well, of exploring those limits and achieving something which is so extraordinary, so far removed from a sort of normal day-to-day existence, that there is an addiction to finding that and exploring that.
100%. You know, look, I'm probably just going to contradict exactly what I just said then, because just a few days ago, almost a week ago now, last Wednesday, I did this Equinox ride, just ride for 12 hours, you know, 12 hours of sunlight in the southern and northern hemisphere. So I went and did a 340K ride because I thought, oh, that'd be cool. I can probably do that in 12 hours, whatever. Why? I could have done 280, I could have done 250 and just slowed it down. But I'm addicted to it. And I feel like, exactly what you said, I like to put myself in this situation and get to this point where I'm like, all right, how am I going to get out of this? And it's weird. Yeah, it is weird. So I am finding it in different ways. I don't need the world tour racing to find it or get it or achieve it. It doesn't need to be on the road, but I am addicted to still getting in that position and challenging my own body.
Well, chaps, I was going to talk a little bit more about trauma relating to, possible trauma relating to Wout van Aert and any trauma that he might harbour vis-a-vis Mathieu van der Poel. Mental blocks, whether Mathieu van der Poel is causing or has caused him a bit of a mental block. I'm inclined to sort of gloss over that a little bit, actually, as we sort of wind down the episode. I don't know what you think. Just quickly, I'll just ask you quickly. I personally think this is a bit of a non-issue. I heard Johan Bruneel in his podcast suggest that maybe Van Aert does have a bit of a mental block towards Mathieu van der Poel. Van der Poel, obviously, having got the better of Van Aert more often than not, certainly in recent times in cyclocross, having won the Tour of Flanders twice to Van Aert's zero victories so far. Chaps, I just think he's Van der Poel is just the stronger and more talented rider, and he's demonstrated this on several occasions. And I think if, you know, these two were going to the sort of last 200-300 meters in races together on a regular basis, and Van Aert was sort of fluffing his sprints and betraying sort of obvious nervousness, then I think we could talk about a mental block, but I just don't see it. What about you, chaps? What do you think?
I think they've just been racing together for so long that it's just something they're used to. I don't think if he's going to have a mental block, it would have happened, you know, many a times. He's worked out how to get over it. So it's just another scenario where he's got to work out how to beat his good old mate Vanderpool, you know?
When you have a rider like Vanderpool who... Were Wout van Aert not around, you'd be saying, you know, he was a sort of once in a generation talent. It's almost because there's the two of them that you can, it's easy to construe a bit of a mental block maybe for Van Aert, just because he's coming up against somebody who is as good as him, or, well, different as well. I mean, Daniel, you kind of saying there that you thought Van der Poel was the better rider, and maybe that's true in the classics, but I'm not sure there are any riders, or certainly I'm not sure Van der Poel could do what Wout van Aert does in the Tour de France. Maybe it's just the balance of the way that Van Aert is as a rider compared to Van der Poel. You know, maybe just there is that little hindrance for him. He's just not quite, if he's sort of talking top trumps, he's just not quite the classics winner that Van der Poel is.
On Van Aert, I did want to take this opportunity just to mention Mitch. You talked a minute ago about the Mitch Docker show. Really excellent episode that you recorded an interview with Tom Boonen, which has gone live in the last few days. And a lot of themes there that might pertain to Wout van Aert as well, particularly Boonen talking about the volume, the kind of amplitude of expectations in Belgium that he faced at certain points in his career, you know, these years when he was performing really well and contending for the major classics, yet it was seen as unsatisfactory, not good enough, a sign that he was sort of on the decline in the Belgian press. And, you know, some of this as well, it sort of, well, it rings true with Van Aert as well. But Mitch, that was obviously, well, it was an episode that you'd wanted to do for a long time. You went to see Tom Boonen at home in Belgium, and I guess an experience that will be memorable for you.
Very, very much so. To sit down with a legend like that in his own house and actually feel like we were mates chatting about one thing that we both love is the Belgian classics. So it was very, very cool. Bit of a fanboy at the start, but settled into it and felt like we could talk about him being at the front of the race, me being at the back, feeling the wrath of his riding up the Tineberg, and me just going, well, that's Boonen up the front there doing that to me. So yeah, look, it was really interesting to try and nitpick a couple of things that I noticed from afar and understand if they were true. The way they rode as a team, also understanding that pressure. I was really interested in that pressure around Belgium and being this superstar from so young. You know, in his first edition as a pro at Roubaix, he was there on the podium with US Postal. So where do you go from there? And at age 24, he was world champion, winning Tour of Flanders as well. So where do you go from there? You know, and as he alludes in the interview, that, you know, finishing second in a race, or, you know, only winning one or two races, was a failure after that. And he had to remove himself because of injury from the bubble and come back. He speaks very well, really humbly. It's a great interview. To plug my own podcast, Life in the Peloton, go across and listen to it. If it's the only one you ever listen to from my podcast, it's worth it, because he's not interviewed that often, I don't feel. And the best thing about podcasting, I feel, even though we're not doing it now, is to do it in person. And then you get that really great rapport. So it's very interesting, especially because I feel he is the king of the classics. Everything he did, the way he wrote, and a lot of people compare him to Van Aert, but I think in terms of results, he's got a hell of a lot more going than Van Aert on the road at the same age, I think.
Yes, and obviously he was a sort of talisman for many years for the Quick-Step team, and well, they're not in a very good way, are they? Maybe you mentioned it earlier in the podcast, Yves Lampaert was their best rider in E3, 28th position. Echoes of last year, incidentally, Patrick Lefebvre, if you remember last year after E3, was also in pretty, well, downbeat mood, and he gave us one of, well, his more memorable sound bites from that spring. He said the only thing that he enjoyed on their V3 last year was his lunch. I think he'd eaten at a 2-star Michelin restaurant in Waregem, and I don't think he's in better mood at the moment. He talked the other day in his column about having been got carried away by the euphoria of good results in 2021 and having re-signed deals with Julien Alaphilippe, Casper Asgreen, and who was the other one? There was another, and Yves Lampaert in 2021 as well. Again, I mean, another sort of broadside from the Lefebvre playbook. I think it was intended as a mea culpa, him trying to show some humility in a period when obviously his statements in the press have been criticised, justifiably so, and he was saying, oh well, this is my fault, but then he kind of undid whatever good work he had done by then naming the riders. He could have just said, I haven't done my job very well, but then to sort of throw the spotlight back on those three riders and say, well, it's basically their fault because they haven't done their job, not great. Chaps, I'm just going to, well, this is a bit of a time-honoured but forgotten tradition of the cycling podcast. When it comes to predictions, I, for some reason, I can't remember why I came up with this. I used to give my 18 riders most likely to win the big races. So my 18 most likely riders to win the Tour of Flanders in order of likelihood, very quickly. Number one, Mathieu van der Poel. Number two, Mads Pedersen. Number three, Wout van Aert. Number four, Matej Mohoric. Number five, Matteo Jorgensen. Number six, Tom Skuins. Bettiol, Stover, Asgreen, Van Baarle, Lazcano, Kung, Trentin, Pollitt. Trentin again. Apparently he's number 13 and 15 in the list. I don't know what went wrong there. And Wellens, Madouas, and Wright. So in actual fact, they're my 17 most likely riders. Chaps, quick prediction.
I'd probably put Stuyven higher up for me, I think, based on what I saw at E3.
Is Pithet...
Pithy's not on the provisional start list, but I think they may well throw him in.
Yeah, I think on the form that he's shown at Gent-Wevelgem, yeah, why not? Chuck him in. But I'm not sure Pithy's quite got the... I can't see a scenario where he would have a chance at winning. He'd have to be up the road, I think, in advance of those final climbs before the top riders really went berserk.
He's got the mini mullet, but not the experience. A name, just a name, please, Mitch. Stuyven from Richard. Mitch?
I'm going to stick with Van Aert. I feel like he's made the right move. We haven't seen the best, and he's going to prove us all wrong from this podcast. This is going to be his chance to shine. And we always see this. I get the feeling with these two guys. Sorry, you just asked for one name, and I'm giving an explanation. Van Aert, Van der Poel, when one does one, the other one comes back and goes, hey, don't you forget about me.
Indeed. Indeed. Chaps, final topic on the agenda. Something completely different. Stage racing. This sort of shadow boxing ahead of the Tour de France between the big four, Roglic, Remco, Vingegaard, Pogacar. The latest salvo was fired by Pogacar at the Volta a Catalunya, as already touched on in the news roundup. Pog incineration at the Volta a Catalunya. Next week, we've got the Tour of the Basque Country, Roglic, Remco, Vingegaard in action. Anything to say about Pogacar and the Volta a Catalunya?
You might like this, Daniel. There's a little Twitter showed me a clip of Dennis Bergkamp scoring a goal. I can't remember when it would have been, like late 90s. And he sort of walks away in disbelief at what he's just done. maybe Pogacar was on my mind, just having watched Catalunya. But the question I thought about that is, to what extent can we just enjoy a rider being that good?
Mm.
I don't know whether it's something specific to Pogacar, that maybe something that he has in his character or his style that other riders, say Jonas Vingegaard or even Remco, don't really have. But I watch Pogacar and I know there's no competition for that race, but there's a smile on my face and I'm kind of thinking, how good would it be to be that good at something that, you know what I mean? It's an enjoyable experience to watch that. I'm not sure that'd be the case for every rider, don't I?
I get that feeling, yeah, watching the Van Aerts and the Vanderpoels and the classics, of course. I'm like, oh, how cool would that be to be able to get crash on the Paterberg and still just get up and, you know, ride back. So to go to Pog is, I love what he's doing. It's just like, it's not just all the tour. I know you guys discussed this last week, but it's like, I'm ticking off each race. I'm going to win every race. And I love that about him. He's just so diverse to become, you know, the greatest rider ever. You know, if that's his motto, I've never heard that, but I love that. And it seems like it's going that way. And it's cool to see. I'm a big fan.
Yeah, there's a sort of bubbling undercurrent of commentary. Is it boring? Is it plausible? Is there something suspicious about this? It will be sort of stopped in its tracks by the fact that Pogacar is not going to ride again until Liège. That's the last stage race he's going to do by the Giro d'Italia. But it might well resume at the Giro d'Italia, particularly with those first two stages, which will give him an opportunity to take the pink jersey. And there's talk already about him maybe becoming the first rider since Gianni Bugno in 1990 to lead from end to end of the Giro d'Italia. But I'm with you guys. I'm very much enjoying it. As we talked about before in the podcast, it really depends on personal preference. Do you like the cut of his jib, among other things? And I find him a very entertaining, swashbuckling rider to watch. And I'm glad that he's not just sort of diplomatically pumping the brakes and dishing out presents in, you know, the last couple of stages in the Volta a Catalunya, and that when there is an opportunity to win, he wins. Chaps, we will see on Sunday who wins the big one, Manchester City or the Tour of Flanders once again. And we will be back next week. So thank you very much. Thanks, Mitch.
Thanks for having me.
And thank you, Rich.
Cheers, Daniel.